Last week I was dealing with the imminent ecological crisis. We carry on now with a quote from the celebrated historian Arnold Toynbee, who in 1973 wrote, "Some of the major melodies of the present day world, in particular the recklessly extravagant consumption of nature's irreplaceable treasures, and the pollution of those of them that man has not already devoured, can be traced back to a religious cause, and that cause is the rise of monotheism." Now, to understand why Toynbee made such a serious and alarming charge, we need to understand how monotheism, or I shall say sometimes monotheism, arose. It's only in very recent times that we have been in a position to write a history of God, as Karen Armstrong has so brilliantly done in a recent bestseller of that name. Throughout most of Christian history, the reality of God as the creator and controller of the universe appeared to be so self-evidently true that it was not open to question. It's only since the time of Darwin that it has become clear that all languages, all cultures, all religions have evolved and are of human origin. The very concept God is the creation of ancient human imagination. And the history of God explains the wide variety of ways in which this idea has been understood. Moreover, and somewhat ironically, the Bible has proved to be a valuable documentary source for writing such a history. So let me briefly sketch the rise of monotheism. All people of primal societies, such as that of the pre-European Maori, saw themselves dependent upon the forces of nature. So our far distant forebears personified these forces as unseen gods and spirits who controlled all the changing phenomena of the natural world. These gods must be obeyed if humans were to continue to enjoy the necessities of life. And chief among the gods were the Sky Father and the Earth Mother. The Sky Father presided over the heavenly bodies and controlled thunder and lightning and storms. The Earth Mother provided for humankind the fruits she produced from her bountiful vegetation. Now, it was the Israelite prophets who, over a period of some 500 years, weaned the people of Israel from dependence on the gods of nature. First, by denying they had any reality, and secondly, by replacing them with the one God they called Yahweh. Henceforth, the prophets declared, not only Israel, but the whole of humankind was to worship and obey only him. It was the subject of the very first commandment. I am Yahweh, your God. You shall acknowledge no other gods before me. And this God was not only the creator and provider, he was also the Lord of human history. And thus came to birth the kind of monotheism which has been the foundation of faith for Jew, Christian, and Muslim to this day. Now, this transition from polytheism to monotheism took centuries, and it's far more complex than the simplistic summary I'm now going to sketch. Because what in effect happened was this: Yahweh was the national God of Israel, who had delivered them from slavery in Egypt. But he had originated as the God of war, who led people to victory, and also as the sky god who manifested his wrath against all misdeeds in storms and droughts. The well-known biblical term Lord of Hosts, or Yahweh of Hosts, can be translated both as God of the armies and God of the stars. And it is this Israelite sky god Yahweh who eventually became transformed into the monotheism of Jew, Christian, and Muslim. And that's why we continue to address him, as we do in the Lord's Prayer, with the familiar words, Our Father who art in heaven. Now, in this transition, Yahweh became universalized, and all other gods were banished from existence. The movement from polytheism to monotheism was a great intellectual and spiritual advance at the time. By replacing multiplicity with unity, it provides an interesting example of Occam's razor. Now, that's a philosophical principle that states that simple theories are to be preferred to complex theories. And it was the simplicity of monotheism that captured conviction. The transition to monotheism had the potential to unify all humankind by means of a common faith. And its capacity to win universal conviction is demonstrated by the fact it's lasted more than 2,500 years, even though it became divided into three main forms, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim. But monotheism also had some very serious implications, and it is only in recent times we have come to recognize these. And the first is that God, having originated as the Sky Father, has always been spoken of in male terms. And that had the effect of nurturing and authorizing patriarchal societies in which women were downgraded. As Mary Daly, the most outspoken exponent of feminist theology, so trenchantly said, "Where God is male, the male reigns supreme." Women came to be considered too earthy to perform holy and priestly functions. And they also constituted a danger to males by deflecting them from the path of humble obedience to God, so their fleshly charms needed to be hidden from male eyes, very dominant in Islam. And even theologians as recently as Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer were still defending the supremacy of men over women on theological grounds. And so the women's liberation movement has rightly contended it has now become necessary to move beyond God the Father. That's the title of Mary Daly's book. Now, secondly, the advent of monotheism annihilated the goddesses of nature. And it did it so successfully that the Hebrew Bible does not even preserve any word meaning goddess. There did survive in the Bible one or two proper names of Canaanite goddesses, such as Ashtoreth, the goddess of fertility, but it survived only after her name had been deliberately disfigured by replacing its vowels with those of the Hebrew word for shame. That exemplifies an ancient form of holy graffiti. And thus the original balance between the genders existing in polytheism became lost in monotheism. And this left women at a spiritual disadvantage, for they had no feminine figure or icon with which they could identify. And that's probably the reason why the cult of the Virgin Mary began to develop in the Christian tradition. It was a way of fulfilling the spiritual vacuum. And that's why Mary came to be referred to as the Queen of Heaven. Now, thirdly, because the Earth Mother was among the gods of nature being annihilated, the earth itself became desacralized. All of its sacred character was effectively transferred to another world, the heavenly dwelling place of God the Father. So the forces of nature now became impersonal things under the control of God, and he could use them for blessing or judgment. Even worse, Christians came to regard the earth as a fallen world, and they believed they saw clear evidence of this in the way the species prey upon one another, nature being red in claw and tooth, as we now say. Now, fourthly, monotheism led to the dualistic worldview, that was so dominant in medieval Christianity, and indeed continues into modern times. And that helped to deepen the contrast between the earthly and the heavenly, the material and the spiritual, the human and the divine, the temporal and the eternal. And so the natural world, previously venerated as the source of all the necessities of life, now became downgraded. The earth was under divine judgment. It was destined for destruction. Fifthly, monotheism preserved in this one God such personal qualities and virtues as were found in the gods of nature. He could even be angry and vengeful. But mostly he came to be conceived as all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving. God was the infinite mind who planned the universe, provided it with its order and wonder, and continued to control its affairs. So that all the gratitude and fear and wonder which the original polytheists had felt towards the gods of nature was now transferred to our Father who art in heaven. Now, humankind's pious worship of the gods of nature had originally held in check the greedy impulse we humans have to exploit it, nature. And as Toynbee said, the rise of monotheism removed this age-old restraint, and it freed humankind to do what it wished with the natural world, even encouraging us to exercise dominion over all living creatures. So that's why Toynbee declared monotheism is responsible for the coming ecological crisis. We should note in passing that the desacralization of the earth did produce some positive results. It enabled the rise of empirical science. Only after the earth had lost its presumed sacred power did the first scientists feel free to experiment with natural phenomena. The German physicist and philosopher Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker suggested in his Gifford Lectures in 1959 on the relevance of science that modern science would not have evolved as it did if it had not been for the Christian doctrine of monotheism. I quote, "The concept of strict and generally valid laws of nature could hardly have arisen without the Christian concept of creation. I call modern science a legacy of Christianity." Now, the enterprise of modern science has undoubtedly been of great benefit to humankind, particularly during the 19th and 20th centuries. But now even science is beginning to raise alarm bells. First, with the creation of nuclear weapons, and now with genetic modification. We are coming to recognize that human technology has now become so powerful it can have a devastating effect on shaping the future. And so Jürgen Moltmann, one of today's leading German theologians, saying much the same as Toynbee, and I quote, "It was the Western religion of modern times that freed the way for the secularization of nature. The ancient view about the harmony between the forces of nature has been destroyed. Destroyed by modern monotheism and by scientific mechanism. Modern monotheism has robbed nature of its divine mystery and has broken its spell." Now, because of the ecological crisis now looming, it has become necessary to move beyond monotheism, beyond the idea of our Father who art in heaven, omnipotent creator and controller of the earth. And this is because, as Jürgen Moltmann says, if modern society is to have any future, what we need above all is a new respect for nature, a new reverence for the life of all created things. But how can Christianity move beyond monotheism? Is it not the very foundation of all Christian teaching? Well, the answer to that question is, strangely enough, yes and no. Yes, because most Christians, including most clergy and theologians, still defend monotheism and focus on the Heavenly Father as if the Heavenly Father alone were God. No, because all these seem to forget too often that pure monotheism was abandoned by Christianity in the 5th century, and it was replaced by Trinitarianism. Indeed, it was because Christianity abandoned pure monotheism that Islam spread so rapidly through Eastern Christendom. In this regard, Islam saw itself as a movement commissioned by Allah to restore a pure monotheism. You see, Christianity, by the 5th century, had created a new image of God, the Holy Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And this creation had become necessary in order to accommodate an entirely new religious doctrine, the doctrine of the Incarnation, the doctrine that God had enfleshed himself in the man Jesus. Now, this doctrine so shocked Jews and later Muslims that they remained to this day pure monotheists. Now, this doctrine implied there is no longer an impassable gulf between heaven and earth, between the divine and human, between the supernatural and the natural worlds. It has been bridged, and God has come down to earth. Now, the doctrine of the Incarnation was the first step in reconnecting the divine creator with creation, or what we call nature. This radically new step away from pure monotheism was destined to lead in the long run to the modern secular world. But why did it take so long? Well, that should not surprise us. The transition from polytheism to monotheism was a slow and complex process that took many centuries. And so the movement beyond monotheism has been a long and complex process. After Christianity had arrived at the twin doctrines of the Incarnation and the Holy Trinity, they proved too revolutionary even for most Christians to cope with, let alone Jews and Muslims. And the human Jesus became lost from view behind the holy, divine Christ figure. The historical appearance of Christ, Son of God, as referred to in the New Testament, was treated as a kind of Hindu-style avatar of God the Father. But the radical significance of the incarnation became obliterated. The gulf between heaven and earth was reopened. It was as if the doctrine of the incarnation had become hijacked. And then, in the 12th century, a brave attempt to reconnect God again with the God of nature was made by St. Francis. And he taught us to value nature for its own sake. And he saluted all earthly creatures as his brothers and sisters. And in the well-known hymn he has bequeathed to us, he even speaks of dear Mother Earth. He founded the order of the Franciscan friars. And out of them came Roger Bacon, the man who took the first practical steps towards empirical science. And he was followed by another Franciscan, William of Ockham, whose philosophy, the Via Moderna, was destined to spell the end of metaphysical speculation, and it helped to promote the Renaissance. And the humanists of the Renaissance, as the leaders were called, affirmed now the inherent value in the human condition. And from then on, people began to look with new eyes at the natural world and at the universe itself. Artists now began to see beauty and wonder in craggy mountains and natural landscapes untouched by humans that they'd never seen before. A tremendous change took place. The Renaissance led to the Protestant Reformation, and this in turn resulted in the closure of the monastic institutions, forcing nuns and monks out into the secular world. You see how secularization is coming on step by step. And then came Galileo, whose scientific exploration of the heavens demonstrated that the heavenly bodies were of the same physical order as the earth. Now all of these facts, in fairly rapid succession, led Western Christianity into accelerating cultural change. It's one in which we humans have come to focus our attention increasingly on the physical universe. It entailed the dissolution of the dualistic worldview and its replacement by today's monistic worldview of a space-time continuum as the only real world that exists. And we now call this process of cultural change secularization. And it is the long-term result of the doctrine of the incarnation. Christians, alas, have been all too slow to realize this. But there has been one. An Anglican theologian, J.R. Willingworth, still widely read when I was young, in an essay in 1891 on the doctrine of the incarnation said, "Secular civilization has cooperated with Christianity to produce the modern world, and it is nothing less than the providential correlative and counterpart of the incarnation." But in this process of secularization, what has happened to God? What does it mean now to speak of God if we go beyond our Father who is in heaven? What is now to be our image of God? Well, these are questions that the Western world has been wrestling with increasingly now for 400 years and throwing up a variety of answers. But those who suggested the new answers didn't receive much help from the church, and often found themselves quite ostracized. Because the church, for the most part, refused even to allow the questions to be asked. Now, one answer that was given is that God is to be found everywhere in the world of nature. And in the 17th century, the Jewish philosopher Spinoza pioneered this answer, and it has been called pantheism. He began to treat the terms God and nature as interchangeable. I doubt if he realized how close he was to the ancient Israelite sages, because they largely ignored the monotheism being promoted by the prophets. The sages never expected to hear any messages from God, nor did they look to God to solve their problems. When they did speak of God, as they occasionally did, they used the word as if it were a symbol of the way things work in the world of nature. You see, Hebrew didn't have any word for nature. And even Jesus of Nazareth seems to have been in the stream of the sages. And that is why he too said, God makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, sends the rain on the just and on the unjust. Here already in the biblical tradition, there is a stream of thought that identifies God with nature in such a way as to acknowledge the amoral character of natural forces. And we may illustrate this by referring to the recent disastrous tsunami. Pure monotheists felt themselves forced to interpret that as an act of divine judgment, as the Anglican Dean of Sydney is said to have done. But the Israelite sages would have said, this is the way that nature operates. One must simply learn to respond accordingly. Because you see, that was the attitude of Jesus in his famous parable, where he commended the wisdom of the man who had the foresight to expect that there would be storms, and so he built his house on a firm foundation. However, the pantheistic answer of equating God with nature has not proved to be wholly satisfactory. First, it seems to make all reference to God somewhat redundant in the end, and hence leads to atheism. And that may well be illustrated by the famous reply of the French scientist to Laplace to Napoleon. When Laplace presented to him his astronomical explanation of the movement of the heavenly bodies, Napoleon asked him about the role of God in his theory. And Laplace simply replied, I have no need of that hypothesis. And so with our growing understanding of the way nature works, there is no need to postulate an infinite divine mind controlling it all for human good. The heavenly bodies, storms, earthquakes, tsunamis, operate according to nature's own internal laws. They are quite amoral, and they are completely disinterested in how they affect earthly life. Secondly, pantheism leaves unanswered other questions which monotheism appeared to answer, such as, why is nature here at all? Why is there something and not nothing? And to meet these, the answer known as deism arose, and it retained sufficient of the monotheistic God as to affirm him as the creator, the first cause, the designer of the laws of nature. But having decreed the laws, the deist God played no further active role in the world, either in physics, so miracles do not occur, or in human history. He never answers prayer or directs human history. Now, what was missing in pantheism, atheism, and deism was any reference to the supreme moral values, love, justice, compassion, which have been claimed as the attributes of God. How are they to be accounted for? Well, the first person in my view who did this successfully was Ludwig Feuerbach in his epoch-making book, The Essence of Christianity, 1841. Feuerbach first shocked the readers of his day by asserting that God is a humanly made concept. Although the Bible states that God made human beings in his own image, the real truth, said Feuerbach, is that humans have made God in their image. And then, using the psychological technique of projection, widely understood today but unknown in Feuerbach's time, he argued that our ancient forebears had unconsciously projected onto this humanly created concept all the moral qualities to which humans aspire, such as justice and love and compassion and forgiveness. Having done that, they are then greatly magnified and judged to be the divine attributes. The personality of God, said Feuerbach, is nothing else than the projected personality of humankind. Now, some people find that conclusion almost commonplace today, while others reject it just as fiercely as they did in Feuerbach's day. As Feuerbach said, God is our highest idea. And that, curiously enough, is how the great Archbishop of Canterbury, Anselm, actually began his famous proof that God exists. Now, what is often overlooked is that in Feuerbach's deconstruction of God, he didn't stop there. First of all, he showed that the very essence of Christianity was the doctrine of the Incarnation. That's why it's the book's title, The Essence. Because by making the human Jesus the new basis of religion and treating him as divine, Christianity was implying that the heavenly throne is now empty. Jesus represented the new humanity, as Paul himself taught. And the new humanity now has to take responsibility for the functions and the goals previously projected onto our Father in heaven. Now, after that, Feuerbach wrote another book called The Essence of Religion, which never received the public attention of the first one. And he pointed out that in his first book, he had been dealing only with the moral and personal attributes of God, but that there was more to be said about God. He said, when God was conceived as the creator and controller of the natural world, he had taken over the functions of the earlier gods of nature. And so the monotheistic image of God also embodied what Feuerbach called the personified essence of nature. Now, it's rather important to see what Feuerbach's done. He has deconstructed the God concept into two quite different orders of reality. The world of nature, as the pantheists and deists wanted to emphasize, and the collection of human values, as the theists have always wanted to emphasize. But as Feuerbach saw it, God was the projection of both the essence of nature and the essence of humanity. And that is why the monotheistic God had long served as a way to understand the world as well as a way to understand the human condition. Now, if theology means the study of God, then Feuerbach's deconstruction of God has resolved theology into two complementary areas of study. The study of nature, on the one hand, and the study of humanity and its values, on the other. And there's a very interesting way of illustrating this by observing what has happened in the last 800 years in the Western institutions of higher learning. Now, they were founded around about the 11th and 12th century, when it was thought that all knowledge could be understood as a manageable unity. And that's why they were called a university. But the medieval universities began with the faculty of theology, because theology was then known as the queen of the knowledges of the sciences. Perhaps the last person to expound all knowledge as a unity was Thomas Aquinas, when he set out to reconcile Aristotle's philosophy of nature with what was assumed to be the truth revealed by God. And this he did in his renowned Summa Theologica, which he unfortunately didn't live to finish. But his synthesis was never universally accepted, except in the Catholic Church. And when it broke down, it opened up the way for an explosion of academic disciplines such as we know in the universities today. And these disciplines still fall into two main groups. The physical sciences study the natural world. The social sciences and the arts study humanity in human culture. These two groups have now replaced what started off as theology in the 12th century, when monotheism was universally accepted. What is more, by the middle of the 20th century, there had been such an evident rift between these two groups that the scientist C.P. Snow became a novelist, in which he wrote a number of novels deploring the bifurcation of society into two cultures which didn't seem to understand each other. By the end of the 20th century, that rift was being partially healed, with more mutual respect being shown between the two. Now let us look briefly at these two. They both began as provinces of theology. I can still remember reading as a student a book with the title, The Lost Provinces of Religion. Now, I was thinking of this first group, the scientific group, when I said earlier that this series of lectures could well be called From Theology to Ecology. I meant we have moved away from focusing our attention on an unseen personal God who designed and controls the world. We now focus our attention on the physical universe itself. And this we have found to be almost infinite in space and time, and it operates according to its own internal laws. We humans are all part of it. We find we are physical organisms who live and die like the simpler organisms in this complex web of life we call the ecosphere. And if we are to live life to the full, we need to understand the ecosphere and respond to it appropriately. Now, one of the most important lessons to learn from ecology is that the forces of nature do not operate according to any moral plan or ultimate purpose. Rather, nature operates quite blindly and amorally, according to what the scientist Jacques Monod has called a process of chance and necessity. Ecology leaves us with no assurance of the kind that monotheism has given, namely that we live in a moral world where everything will work out for the best in the end. Nature shows no special interest in the human race. So when we move beyond monotheism, we no longer have any divine deliverer we can turn to. Rather, we must now treat the forces of nature with the respect that they deserve, for our life and well-being depend on them, and we know not when or how they may bring life to an end. Witness the sudden end of the age of the dinosaurs. Now, such a view of nature, incidentally, is not wholly foreign to the biblical tradition. We find it, as I have already pointed out, in the sages, and Ecclesiastes observed more than 2,000 years ago that we humans are all subject to time and chance. It sounds terribly modern. Now let me turn briefly to the other area, that of the human cultures and values, because this is the one to which traditional academic theology began to retreat. As our ancient ancestors began to ask basic questions about human existence, they created the many cultures and religions as their answers. And that's why the concept of God came more and more to embody our highest values and to satisfy our search for meaning and purpose. So now that this concept has been deconstructed, the word God is left a bit in limbo. Is it to be used or not? Well, it can remain useful as a symbolic embodiment of our desire to find meaning in life, and of all the values which seem to lay a claim upon us, like love and justice and truth. And that's why the theologian Gordon Kaufman thinks we do need this word God even as a symbol, because it serves, he says, as an ultimate point of reference. It enables us to unify and order our experience of reality in the mental world we construct for ourselves. But the image of God that remains is not that of a planning, caring, personal being, but rather the sum total of all the values we once described as his attributes. God is the symbolic name for the collection of our highest values, says Don Cupid. Well, this process actually began in the New Testament, which already says God is love. But in modern times, it's gone much further. Mahatma Gandhi, for example, said God is truth. And Leo Tolstoy in War and Peace said life is God, and to love life is to love God. And interestingly, Don Cupid has made a study of how our daily language is changing. And he spotted a whole collection of phrases now coming into common use that include the term life. How's life treating you? That's what life is all about. I need to move on in life. Well, get a life. It's as if in daily secular life, we are unconsciously turning to the word life as a natural replacement for the once common term God. So Gordon Kaufman, in his book In Face of Mystery, says, to believe in God today is to commit oneself to a particular way of ordering one's life and action. It's to devote oneself to working towards a fully humane world within the ecological restraints here on planet Earth, while standing in piety and awe before the profound mysteries of existence. So the greening of Christianity stands in marked contrast with much of traditional Christianity. In the latter, we humans saw ourselves as helpless creatures dependent solely on the grace and power of a supernatural God. In green Christianity, we find that the responsibility for our future and for the future of the ecosphere has been placed upon us. By our chosen actions, we must enflesh the values we once regarded as the attributes of God. That's what the doctrine of the incarnation means. And we are required to be perfect in the way God symbolized perfection. Of course, as you surely recognize, I'm simply quoting what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. And are we really up to it? Well, because of the ecological crisis, we have no option but to try. And how we may try, I shall explore next week.